no Buddha, no anybody offers a religion that way. See, there he is one with all of mankind. Why did you forsake me? Now, if that doesn't speak, then I don't really know where we're going to reach people. But have you noticed journalism of late? A couple years ago, was it Look or Life? Had a tremendous issue on the black ghetto. The picture on the cover was this young black boy, a tear running down his cheek. One of the really great bits of journalism in the last 5 years. And then you follow the pictures through, and all it does is gear in on the total hopelessness, aloneness, the locked-inness of this boy's life. About a year ago, one of the magazines had a similar kind of thing about Appalachia. Remember that picture of this couple in this hovel, you know, in Appalachia, and what is it? They're locked in, no way out, meaningless, alone, absolutely no hope. As a Christian communicator, I dare to say this is the kind of savior I have to offer you, not a hero figure at all, but who on the cross actually went through the time when he seemed to be wondering, you know, if he was right. All locked in. There was no way out. The people taunted him and said, well, if you're really, you know, if you're really somebody, come on down from there. Yeah, that would prove something. You know, you got some superhuman powers. And no, he couldn't come down and remain whom he came to be. Now, he didn't do this in a contest, you know. He did this in sheer, total commitment to his faith, his conviction that this was what God wanted him to do, and that this was right. And I never cease to be amazed at the impact of this one lonely deed upon all of civilization. Now, well, we're all locked in, aren't we? Not every single one of us here is locked in. No matter if you've got three cars and four airplanes or you go on foot, you're locked in. It's just the dimension of your fences and horizons that defines it. You're still locked in. Yeah, we're going to the moon, and we're going to conquer space, and I'm just rejoicing in it with all of you, but, you know I'm going to die. And I'm locked in. You may be locked in with a PhD, or you may be locked in with a third grade education, but you're locked in. It doesn't really matter, you know, what the environment. The essential you is some kind of a prisoner. What you really want to do is become a person, and you want to find some kind of power, some meaning, some life. The Christian gospel says you don't have to go looking for it, you see. It's right here, right where you are. Without changing a thing, without even, you know, believing anything more or repenting, but just being open to God or life or something. Well, then how does that come in? And the Christian task, the communicating task, is to somehow, through this Christ, this Jesus, there isn't anywhere else to go at that point. And I've looked. At that point, I go to him, and there I touch God. Now, sure, It's not some great big metaphysical game at that point. Got a neighbor boy, one of the most locked in kids I've ever known. He's locked in a very smug community in which we live, very self-righteous community, purist community, success complex community, pure white, WASP community, strongly Lutheran community, educated community, universities on either side and two seminaries in between. There he's locked in, this poor kid who doesn't have a father. He's born out of wedlock, his mother never married. For some strange reason, she decided to raise him there, alone, in a welfare house, working in the state fair horse stables once in a while, cleaning out manure. He's become very, very locked in, introspective, angry, bitter. I've seen by watching how the storekeepers treat this boy, who is essentially a good boy. Once he was kicked by a horse and almost killed, and we really didn't know them. You know how hard it is to reach a locked in person? And he was in the hospital, and I stopped in to see him. And he was almost delirious. I didn't even know if he'd known I was there. Just stopped in as a neighbor. That's all I've ever done for him. When we came back from our sabbatical 4 years ago, the people who came to welcome us were he and his mother. I about cried. I could hardly stand it. If that one visit was all that's ever entered his life, it is beyond me to comprehend the depths of his loneliness. But he's not, you know, atypical. He is a parable of the way you feel, really. And I feel, really, when we come to grips with this thing called being human. I don't really exult in my muscles at that point, or my brains, or my talents, or anything. I just feel terribly alone. And the cross says at that very point of aloneness, there is a person, there's a presence, there's a power, there's an answer. Use whatever word you want. I don't really care. And that's this Jesus Christ. I've had all kinds of personal problems with it because I'm too rational. I want to answer too many questions. I want to settle it first. I want to solve it. All of this business. But in faith and in the experience of just trying it, you know, something happens called the visitation of the Holy Spirit, which is reality. I know it's true. Now, I want to preach that. See, I've got to preach that. You've got to preach that. And when you preach that, boy, you're not arguing with anybody. You're not out to win a thing. Your status is not at stake. Your rightness is not at stake. Nothing is at stake except this person and his need. See? And therefore, sometimes you don't say anything because maybe their experience of grace is only on a human level. And maybe all they can think of is thanking you or someone else. And in the name of that cross, you don't say, now put the Christian tag on this, you know, that you're doing. No. See, your job is at that point not to get them to buy even your creed. Your job is to get them to be warm, you know, to know someone cares. The word that lies behind the cross is the Greek word agape. Love that never asks a reward, never asks a return, just loves for the sake of loving. Now, as a pure idea, it's the most cruel thing you can say to anybody. To tell me to love agape love is to kill me. I can't do it. And any of you can do it. I wouldn't trust any of you with agape. On your own. Nobody. But maybe I can reflect just a fraction of some agape that's been created in me. That's what I preach for. That's the church's communication job. That's what we mean that the church is expendable. I'm expendable. You're expendable. In the long run, it doesn't matter what happens to us. I have a hunch that if Jesus were on the earth because of this great drive of just caring for the human value of people, and knowing that this human value really can only be ensured as they know that there is God, a Father, who knows and cares. And they can't explain anything, but somehow, you know, this is it. It's not just a universe of rules. It's not just a universe of principles and causes and effects. I mean, I don't see how you can talk about human values and leave out personal Father. I mean, I just can't really put the two together. It's like acting out a drama on a stage that's got a different stage setting. It just doesn't go. That's how I feel. On the basis of my reading of the Bible. Nevertheless, what he would say then, since you are really concerned with human values, one of the ways you'd be preaching would be to listen. I grew up in the days of the old science-faith debate. And the big thing that bothered me was that nobody was listening to anybody. They're just fighting everybody. I think he would say, you know, listen to the science field. Listen to it. Just listen. They're saying great things about this world you live in, you know. Great things. Another big debate was with the humanists. I think he would say, listen to the humanists. Work alongside the humanists. Make common cause with the humanists as a Christian. As a Christian. I think he would say, listen to the state. Any state, Khrushchev, or, he's out, isn't he? I can never remember the name of this before, you know. And that's a symbol of our day. You know, there are no more charismatic personalities permitted. I mean, you've got to, in terms of your groups. But listen, they too are trying to preserve order in this world, and so on. And then I have a hunch that what he would say at the end is that if you listened with this passion, because that's part of what you mean by the cross, is that they would say, you know, these Christians are different than I thought. They care about the things I care about. They're interested in what I'm interested in. And, you know, they do a pretty good job, too. And there's something else about them that really bothers me. They seem to have something else, something different. What do you think that differentness is? Well, if you look for it and try to create it, you know, you'll make of yourself a monster. This differentness is only a kind of a gift of God. It is, I think, a reverence for life, a humility, as over against the sheer gift of grace, and an absence of panic in the presence of pressures, problems, pain, and evil. My name for this is the presence of Jesus. But I think that I have a feeling that the door to our age is a real honest looking at the cross. Take away all your hero pictures of this Jesus. Just take a look at him dying. He emptied himself. He died. You know, that thirst. Or take a look at him just before he went on the cross. He said, God, you know, I wish you'd take this cup away from me, but if you don't, your will be done. Sweat blood, says one of the writers, and so on. And when I've been reading that lately, I've been impressed with the fact that there is no record of him getting any audible answer. In the Mount of Transfiguration, they say they heard a voice and so on. One of the writers says angels came to minister to him, to support him. The thing that I see in Jesus at that point is that he got no answer. No answer. And that was his answer. We've been talking about the silences of God. Why do we have to prove him at all? The Bible doesn't try, it just assumes him. I don't know about you, but I've had my black times. You know. Praying and praying and praying. Some sign, some answer, something. And man, have you noticed how they don't come? Nothing. Maybe that's your answer. In the silence, God's probably speaking more immutably than ever. In that way, he kind of stripping away all these answers, which if they do come, may actually destroy faith. Sometimes we do this in the name of creedal statements. You see. But faith is this very tenuous clinging to life on the basis of a word, a life, a death of Jesus Christ. Now, I know this is second article theology. And a good case could be made for contact with our day on the basis of a first article theology, the God of creation. I think we've got to recognize it. But no matter what you say about God, whether he's cosmic ether or personal father or whatever you say, remember Harry Emerson Fosdick's great phrase, it doesn't really matter how you describe him. You're always doing it as a leap of faith. Nobody knows. Nobody knows. Everyone is just interpreting some evidence as a basis of faith. And I choose the evidence of a person, and that is the person Jesus Christ. I think we are being ushered into a day when the great, great reality of his presence in the form of the Holy Spirit may be the great factor, but you'll never ever get rid of Jesus Christ. It's an amazing thing. He's here. And the fact of Jesus, I think, is the cross where we can touch people. I think we've used the cross as a club. That's wrong. We've used it to kind of drill a hole into people inside to make them feel guilty so that they will need it. That's wrong. We've used it as a kind of a proof passage thing. That's wrong. I've listened to sermons on the cross that really just bored me silly. Thundering about the cross, you know, great big exhortations not to be ashamed of it and all that sort of stuff. And not that. The cross really is the place where God, man, really touch. And where they touch, it's always at the point of reality, not unreality. The point of where you live, where you feel, you see. There's where it touches. And if that doesn't drive us to, you know, to care so much about people that we, you know, may be in danger of being called humanists because we care for them so much, you see, then maybe it's missed its job. But as a friend of mine says, who kind of, you know, just has fun giving away his time and money, I say, do you preach when you give it away? Oh, no. I just see people who've got problems and I give it to them. If they do me the great favor of asking me why I'm doing it, I tell them, I've got a great friend, Jesus, and you know, he's filled me so full of joy that I'm kind of saying thank you to him. I kind of like that. Simple, but as always, you know, some of the simple things are the place where reality is. And I guess I think the church today is being called upon to preach by far, far more reckless concern for people, just because they're people. No other reason. They're just here. And this will become a leaven, salt. I don't think you preach by leading with doctrinal statements and getting intellectual agreement first, ever, never. But that doesn't mean that if the fountain that is the life and the death and the resurrection of Jesus Christ were stopped, I believe the world would dry up. I think it would dry up. I think he's the fountain. How he's related to all that's going on, I don't really know. I don't have to solve that problem. I personally like Toyohiko Kagawa's, a great Japanese humanist, welfare, philanthropist, Christian, missionary, evangelist, you know, everything of the period between the two world wars. And his analogy, he was converted to Christianity, he studied at Princeton, he studied the world over. And as he studied the world religions, he said he was pretty much convinced that Judaism, his own Shintoism, Buddhism, Mohammedanism, all of them were different forms of Old Testament theology. True, they were right, up to a point. All of them incomplete. The incompletion was that none of them really settled the matter, the human matter. Jesus did this. So in a sense, when he says, I am the way, the truth, and the life, you know, he's saying, you know, everything you're looking for, you will find in me. That doesn't make me proud, argumentative, going out, you know, to win people for my point of view. It just gives me an impetus for caring and loving and working. And that's about it. Maybe some of you want to talk.
It seems to me that the history of not only preaching, but the history of the mission of the church is of course, emphasize so strongly the death, the crucifixion of Christ. I wonder if in our emphasis we have neglected to emphasize the total giving of God of himself in life.
Yes, I think that could be done.
And in a day and age in which there's so much desire for life, I think, and so much desire that there be some meaning in life, that we emphasize that God gave himself in life. And this life reached its climax, or what God did was most deeply seen in the crucifixion, but it was in living where God gave himself in community. I'm searching for an idea here. I'm not exactly certain how to follow this through, but to emphasize not so much that Christ died for you, but God gave himself in Jesus Christ for you.
Yeah, yeah. That the crucifixion then is a... If you need a model for talking about it, is simply that this is how much God loved you, period. This is a picture of love and care and concern. And life is this kind of loving.
Yeah, but it was his total life, which was for you.
Yeah.
And this does not negate the crucifixion.
When I talk about the crucifixion here, I'm talking about the crucifixion not as a separate thing from his life, but as the interpretive door to his whole life.
Well,
the purpose for his life was
in his life or in his,
in his total life. Where else was
but
God?
If he left out the end.
I didn't say that.
No,
I didn't say
no,
I negated that.
That's the unique part.
I think we've got to
I think
be a little
right,
more true in our emphasis here. In
I think
God
the crucifixion is the door to his whole life. That's right.
Well, but if you stop at the crucifixion without giving full emphasis to the resurrection, then the circle is not complete.
No, and the fact that he lives today.
Well, that, of course, is the outcome of the resurrection.
It's all part of the picture.
Because I like the emphasis here, because I think what we do today, we run away from the death thing, you know, which really kind of, when we face that, you know, like Eustace says, we can't stand to face death very long because we just have to stand, you know, and kind of shudder. We have no answer, you know, so we just kind of crumble. And our idea is going to crumble in the face of, you know, reality of death. And so without that, and in a day that's kind of toning down death, life doesn't mean anything for me unless I face the reality of death, the idolatrous kind of worship.
Well, of course, our very culture has done everything in the world to hide the fact of death. You know, we go die in hospitals instead of home, and the morticians do everything to get around the fact of death, you know.
But there are people who are facing this tremendously, and that is the people who face the feeling in the nation that you're not really patriotic unless you're willing to go and stop a bullet. These people are facing death now. Maybe they're also running away from it, but it's there. It's a reality, and I think. In the younger generation at this point, there's a crying out, well, isn't life more than just stopping a bullet for your country? How about living for my country, not dying for my country? Dying if necessary, but live.
Then I think part of the problem there too is, you know, has the country become an idol, an idolatry? Is, you know, democracy a form of idolatry? So then am I really dying for this dream of idolatry, which is really this absurd Christianity? Not done, you know.
Well, I agree with you. I think that what the cross says about the way it sets a style for how you live, you know, for your country. See? You live sort of always by dying, Paul points out, see. And by dying, meaning that you're living for someone else all the time. And really, you know, it's absurd to tell people to live this way unless they've been motivated to live this way somehow. It's the height of cruelty to tell people to be unselfish, you know, and so on, unless you can give them some kind of motivation. And that's really where I mean the cross is kind of the interpretation of the whole life of Jesus. But you're right on that, I think we have to talk about life. What I was thinking when you were talking was that as a Christian church, we've got a fantastic range of chords, to use a musical analogy. You know, a fantastic range of melodies with which you can, you know, reach out for people. And it may be that sometimes we play one chord, you know, life and so on and so on. We've got to recognize that. But one thing that I think we have to see and ask ourselves seriously is which chord seems to be the one to pluck today, you know, for our mood, the kind of life. Now, you're really saying that today there's a call for life. And I see a real absorption with death. I think that Camus and a whole lot of them have really raised the real issue of our day, and they so much talk about suicide, for instance. And here is really a kind of a picture of the loneliness, meaninglessness, frustration of life, and I've got to speak to that at some point.
I see in the youth culture, you know, a couple things like it's like the whole kind of rock scene right now is a whole scene of despair.
Yeah.
You know, all the songs are typically songs of despair. And that came after a kind of a whole fascination with the mystical religions. And that burned out, you know. Beatles tried it, everybody tried it, and, you know, burned out. Went into the LSD kind of mystical thing and found the peace, but the peace didn't square away with reality. Just you know, somehow. Then move into despair, which is where we're at now.
And despair, if it becomes nihilism, you know, is...
Is that really a move from mysticism? Is it a matter of one burning out, or is it simply a continuation of? Like the three stages of syphilis. They're distinctly different, however, they're the same disease.
All aspects of a search, I think, or, you know, where's the meat? Where can I really hook in, you know? So I try a lot of different bags, a lot of different things, and try that, and it didn't seem to square with reality, so, you know, try something else. But then I kind of give up, you know, hopelessness, and then sing about my hopelessness that I really don't have.
Well, I think there is in our culture a very deep-seated and easily demonstrable death wish. I was just thinking again of the automobile, the advertising. In the European countries, cars are advertised as to economy, the small amount of space they take up, all of the economic factors. We call our cars, you know, Panthers and Tornadoes, and they're a weapon, you know, of destruction, and then how fast they can go. It doesn't make a difference. You know, we have speed limits. In Europe, they don't have speed limits. And yet, we build our cars to go 30, 40, 50 miles above the speed limit. It's the power, you know, the destructive power in an automobile that is advertised, that catches the imagination. And I think a lot of it is an appeal to this deep-seated death wish that we as a culture seem to have come up with. We're fascinated, preoccupied by death.
Of course, we're also...
I'm not so sure that, you know, the death wish, although I'm not gate. I'm wondering too if we have a strong power, that is a, I think the expansion, the development of a frontier was a great ego expansion. And you know, came as poor member of folk powerless. And came on this virgin scene and, you know, made everything powerful. And it seems to me that what kind of leaves me sort of ambiguous about this discussion so far is that I'm wondering if we're not talking about the people we know who are going through these second thoughts of that American life. But I wonder if most Americans still aren't pursuing the historic. That's what I was trying to argue this morning. Mm-hmm. We're still pursuing the historic, upward and outward expansive development of ourselves.
And I wonder if we don't feel somewhat stymied about the fact that we've reached the Pacific Ocean.
Yes, and now the moon maybe. And maybe, you know, we're beginning. I think we're beginning to see that we've been on a wild chase. And life isn't satisfied that way. But I get the feeling that a lot of people are really quite content with their life in American life. And the very fact that they're quite unwilling to share their resources, that's the exception of a person who shares because he's just so joyful in Christ. Look at how hard it is to raise money for anything that you really think is redemptive in our society. I find it I almost despair when I think of the future of education. Or the future of so many other good things. Mm-hmm. I think the ethics of the business society is still fundamental ego expansion, ego expansive.
Should we preach then to the church or to the society?
No, I think unless we get to the people. You know, preach to the people in society, wherever they are.
And not think of them in either category, but just as people.
I was going to say, how can you separate them?
Yeah.
I as an individual, live in society and am a part of the church, and you preach to me as a total person.
But I'm thinking in terms of your presuppositions, you see. It's quite a difference if I have a presupposition that God's got a right to my life, and if I don't have a presupposition, you see, in that sense, I mean preacher, the church. But if you mean church and society, that we're all together, why sure.
Well, isn't it possible that this nation started from Europe, from fragments of protesters, if you will, that chose to believe in their own fashion, to follow God's wishes, and to carve the kingdom, so to speak, under his direction, and always following God's rules, it seems, both in the Old and the New Testament, that when you do this, he unleashes a great deal of power, and the power then is given to the people, and as in Israel, it's not necessarily taken back. It's given and you use it.
Yeah.
Well, there's another force in the world. And if you consider that force, and if you relax your faith in God over a period of time, isn't it possible that this other force can subtly take that power and polish it up and shine it and make it gleam and drive your head right against a brick wall? This death wish, rather than being an individual, it's like a magnet, how it changes all the little molecules in a piece of iron to point the same way. This
course, it does the same thing to each individual person, so that it becomes, rather than a social problem, a spiritual problem, something like that. So, it appears to be within our control, not necessarily.
Yeah.
I think it might help if we recognize it.
Mm. Yeah.
You're talking about life. I can't get that out of my mind, Paul. When I choose the motif of the cross, I know all the hang-ups. I've had them. I've been subjected in my lifetime to my share of preaching, which were in the name of the cross. I'm supposed to feel a certain kind of guilt or need or shame or something or other, and therefore need what it has to give. I'm not really, you know, I'm asking maybe that this is not the original way, you see. This is a something we've done along the way. Maybe in the name of pietism or something, you know. And I'm quite aware, because I've lived in that stage, that you can live a very healthy, happy, carefree life without having any worries about life's meaning or ultimacy, you know, or concerns or sin, or, you know, just live a happy animal life, see? And I'm saying that if you're going to hook your communication onto trying to prove to a happy person that he's unhappy, you know, therefore needs Jesus, no, forget it. But the cross is thereby not negated. See, the cross really is where life really is finally seen in this one stark great moment, you know, including this demonic that you're talking about.
One of the big problems last night seemed to be that that being true, you still have the very vast majority of people unaffected by it.
Yeah.
The cross obviously is God's plan of salvation. Must we not therefore accuse God of radical failure? Mm. Here's the only solution, the only salvation, and people aren't buying it.
Mm. Well, there
is in the Old Testament something called a remnant theology.
Yes.
In the long run, you know, we see, we still live by faith.
Don't you think, too, though, that many people that aren't Christians can't imagine why they would want to be a Christian? Because I know what he means. They don't see the joy of the Lord or the happiness. So who wants it?
Well, besides that, they were talking about people all over the world that have had no opportunity to know of Christ. And are they being thrown into eternal damnation because of this? Or does Christ appear? Or does God personify himself to them and their manifestations?
The minute we start comparing people, we fall into real trouble. See, Jesus warned us of that. He warned us that as Christians, we're going to meet non-Christians who are better than we are. So when I said, you know, part of our preaching is listening, I think we should also listen to the world conscience. And there are certainly, in non-Christian sources, people who seem to have a more sensitive conscience than the Christian church. But he said, that doesn't mean that you settle for some kind of common denominator. You see, there is a higher thing. The thing that really I personally can never get rid of as a Christian is his word, what do you do more than that? That's the thing that bugs me. It isn't whether I'm better than or different from, you know, but how much of this real love of God for man in Christ really has taken over in you? You know, there are times when I sometimes think I should be just a kind of a nut. And then I'm scared to be a nut, you know. That's the thing that I think the cross is trying to say. And if we'd kind of quit worrying about statistics and differences on that level, you know, just honestly be what we think Christ wants us to be. And that's about all we can do. But when I look for the place where I can hang on to it, I just can't get rid of the cross. That's where I go.
The cross in yourself, though, is each day you have to die to yourself in order to let Christ live. And we don't do that every day.
No.
Yeah. One of the things that has struggled with us has been the fact that it seems to me so much of organized life is based on the negation of the cross.
Yeah.
And it seems to me you have to say that we are committed, that our culture is committed to a negation of the cross.
Right.
And that America's achievement has been based on the negation of the cross. Yeah. We may have to face it, but if we should really live by this conviction of the cross, we would be failures.
Yes.
In the American scene.
Paul Homer makes this point over and over again.
Yeah. And you know, most of us like to be successful, and we are pretty successful. I think if we look at a little sample of we're all pretty successful people.
Yeah.
You know, we can live wherever we went. If we choose, we can live in the inner city. If we can choose to live in the suburbs, we can get a little place up in the mountains. So we're kind of privileged people. And how do we get to this freedom of choice? Because we have pursued the culture. We've been nurturing the values of America, which says get aggressive, hard work, live, and education. But don't get too worried about, don't give too much too early to somebody else. Because if you do, you're going to stifle your own development. And so in the academic field, we are told to get cosmopolitan. Don't commit yourself too much to community. Mm. If you do, you're not going to develop your profession sharply in there. Go to the conventions, not necessarily listen to speeches, but to cultivate friends and associations. There's where the new opportunities for teaching assignments are, or for research posts. The most successful of us are really saying, don't give up of yourself. Expand yourself. And ultimately, I get the feeling that if we should really take the cross seriously, we may have to say no to a lot of the things that we're now enjoying.
Do you feel that maybe part of the big sharpening of issues today is I have to get back to the church terminology, is to face up to the, make the church face up to this fact that one of her basic roles at this point is to die.
Yeah, and not to put the religious sanction upon the cultural fabric around.
Yeah, for the sake.
Yeah.
Yeah, but in our individual churches, who usually ends up president of the board?
Oh, I know.
The man who gives the most.
Yeah. Not often. Not always. In my church, it was the guy who owned the most. Then he tried to make a religion out of, you know, his success cult.
Yeah.
Well, I thought that's why they weren't president of the council, because they gave the most. They didn't have to do anything else.
Well, the churches I've been in, that was not the case.
Well, is it? I feel a real weight of what Joel said, and I'm left with a question that has persisted for me since I was in college, and I read that Christ said, give, if you've got two coats, why give one to somebody else? And I went out and bought a new suit, you know, and I had a sport coat, a suit that was 3 years old, and it had two buttons instead of three, but it was a good suit, you know. And last night in discussion, somebody said, well, if this is really true, if the cross is really true in the sense that you may be saying aren't, then why aren't we up in and getting crucified, eh? So I wonder if there's any sense in saying that the meaning of the cross is that it's not a description of the way things ought to be, it's a description of the way things really are. That is, I don't know if this makes sense to you or not, but to say that it's not, the cross isn't telling you what you ought to go and do, it's telling you what is true right now at the middle of your life, however you pursue
it. It tells you where reality really is.
Yeah, it tells you that it is, you know, this old cliche about life as a cruciform shape, but that at its guts or at its bottom, that is what happens in human life. I mean, surrounded it may be by motorboats and cars, but that is what happens, and every man knows that in a real sense, and that this is the point at which one can go and say to the whole world that Christianity has a meaning and something to say about the human condition that is truly universal. I thought that's what you were saying before. So that it's not saying you ought to go and get yourself crucified. It's telling you that you are being, and that the center of your life is in this way, and that there are two kinds of people, those that know it and those that don't. And the man who does know it presumably has some advantages in terms of understanding.
Is that the way you would interpret Jesus' word then, take up your cross?
Yes, I think I would have to try to explain that in terms of what I'm saying here. Obviously, that
I mean, he's the guy who knows it, and so he carries it.
I think so.
Well, up to a point, I can buy that, but not all the way.
Well, then why don't we sell all the suits we have?
Yeah, Robinson. I was thinking of this. Honest to God Robinson. Mm-hmm. There's so many Robinsons. He's a guy with three initials, isn't he? Mm-hmm. J.A.T. Robinson. Has a very good little pamphlet on the new morality. Four chapters. I guess not many people have read it. It's a... What?
Is it by Foster?
By Robinson. J.A.T. Robinson.
Christian Morals Today.
And he deals with this very problem, I think, very helpfully. He points out, for instance, that one of the methods used in the Bible is, I forget what word he uses, not exaggeration, but the method of all that Jesus uses in his parables, for instance, is to isolate all things, all meaning, into one event or one person. The widow who gave her mite. This doesn't mean that she becomes an example that everyone is supposed to go and give away all his money. That becomes a legalism. But in her is concentrated a picture, you know, of the way, really, the self-givingness of life, see? For if everyone gave away his money, then, you know, Thorstenson maybe not even have a job, how would we live, see? I mean, this could be just chaos. The same thing when I talk about the cross, I would hope that it's never put down as a kind of a legalistic principle, a moral principle. You know, now everybody go and do this, you see. But this is the exaggerated center. Now here, suddenly all of life is compressed right here in this thing. And if I want to get power and meaning and integration and center or whatever you want to call it for my life, that's where I go. But then I have to work it out. And in our day, as you've been pointing out, this is the pattern of organized society, and I got to try to, you know, work this out in a communal way, so that it's wrong to lift these out as examples that everybody should follow. Nevertheless, I have no problem, you know, with a strange guy who decides to live this way. You see. That's great.
Maybe the cross was that too, then.
Yeah, I mean, then what do you say about Jesus? He's a strange guy who chose to live this way, but...
No, I'm not talking about Jesus. I'm talking about somebody, some
neighbor. Yeah, but he was totally self-emptying, and you're,
that's
and
right.
It seems to me you're
that's
saying
right.
we really...
Therefore, he that. Is the power source
yeah.
for all persons
but we
who want
can't
to
do that all the way.
No.
I mean, you got to keep
no.
a couple suits anyway. I mean, yeah, but he said to try to be, didn't he? I mean, if we're going to take his word, he said to try to be just like him.
Could I just be pragmatic about this?
Yeah.
Then why do you say that?
If we take the world as it is, well, okay, that's the way it is now. Most of us live in suburbia, fairly affluent, or the edge of the city, and I don't think those of us who live in the central city on the edges, in the self-righteous about it, we share the same kind of celebration of our own achievements. But if we really took the crossroads, we'd say, okay, now, really, you know, we're going to have to reshuffle our budgets a little bit. Just think about all the things that could be done for people in need if some of us reshuffled our budgets and put a little less money into bigger boats. I think that hits sort of sharply in Washington area. Because of the very proximity to Puget Sound, and there's nothing other than that. But, and began to say, well, okay, you know, there are kids in the slums who really don't get education. What in the world are we doing in the state legislature? Maybe we're going to have to begin not only to say, we insist on a different tax program. I think that's one way to say, and I want a tax bite on my income so that the kids in the suburbs and in slums can get the same educational opportunities as my children get. That's a kind of a implementation of this, isn't it?
To make a Christian state of it, then, huh? Rather than taking care of the Christian responsibility first, when you turn it over to the state, say, you take the money from me and you handle it.
What's wrong?
I don't
what's
need
wrong
to
what's, what's wrong with the...
Not
making this the ultimate goal, but, you know, making the state one of the tools.
In a corporate society, that's, you know,
yeah.
we used to have the government of the municipality as a political structure.
Yeah.
Today it has to be the state.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because the municipality, what happens now is that the municipality puts a sanction on gross inequality and lovelessness and non-sharing.
Well, now this is a session in communication. Every one of you complains when the sermon goes over long. And one of the aspects of communication is that no good sermon solves every problem. So I would suggest the bell means drink coffee, the time is up, and if your interest is aroused, you know, keep on thinking about it.